Okay, I guess we should get started. So last week we started to cover some of the features of Prologue that go beyond the sort of pure logical core. And today we'll continue with some features that are sort of inspired by logic and have some logical basis, but don't always behave completely declaratively. So in particular, we'll talk in a fair amount of detail about a feature called negation is failure, and then also a technique for changing the definitions of predicates dynamically at runtime called using predicates called assert and retract. And finally, about ways of collecting all the solutions to a given query. So actually, I think somebody asked about that way back in the first or second lecture. So this is the answer, how to do that. So let me start out by recalling this cut predicate that we discussed quite a lot last week. So remember that the idea of this is that it's a goal which will always succeed, but will have a side effect on the proof state that sort of discards alternative ways of solving the part of the problem that you're currently paying attention to. So this is, you know, a very kind of twisty and unpredictable feature. And so the tutorial problems, I think next week we'll cover a lot of concrete examples of how cut behaves, and hopefully that will help. But so for now, I want to recall this negation behavior that we looked at in the first tutorial, when, for example, we wanted to define predicates that, for example, include siblings defined as somebody that have the same parent, but with a exception that says, except, I'm not my own sibling, for example. So we have this, we can think of negation as being definable in terms of cut in the following way. So this is based on proof search interpretation of negation, where you say, if I can't find a proof of it, then I conclude that it's not true. So the idea is that if we want to solve a goal the negation of G, then first we try to solve G, and if we find a solution, then we'll do a cut predicate, and that will throw away other possible solutions. And then we'll require trying to solve a predicate like fail or false that always fails. So the idea is if G succeeds, then this cut will have effect, and then there will be no solution to the negation of G. On the other hand, if we can't find a solution to G, then we'll never reach this cut, and we'll never reach this failure. And instead, we'll backtrack before we get to the cut and try this alternative solution on the other side of the OR there. So the high level view of this is that we try to solve G, and if solving G yields an answer, then the overall not G predicate will fail. Otherwise, we'll succeed. So here's how this works in a little bit more detail. Suppose we want to try to solve a goal not member of 1 in the list 2-1. So logically, this should fail because member of 1 in the list 2-1 is true. It succeeds. Proof search for that should succeed. So let's see how that goes. If we expand the definition on the previous slide out, then we see that we have to solve member 1, 2, 1, and then cut, and then fail. And also, there's an alternative solution that we could try if this part of the proof search tree doesn't yield any results. We can use the definition of the membership predicate to reduce this to member 1, 1, then cut, then fail, using the second rule for membership. And then using the first rule for membership, we can dispose of this rule. And then we can solve this cut subgoal, and I've denoted this with this kind of star shape here. And remember, when we encounter a cut subgoal, basically we're going to look at other places where we could have pursued alternative proofs between where we are now and the point where the cut was introduced. So in particular, this alternative part of the proof search tree is in the scope of the cut. So when we solve the cut goal, that the cut itself will succeed, but these alternative proofs that we could have looked for will disappear. And then we'll encounter this fail subgoal here, and that always fails, so we'll stop and we'll reset. And since there now aren't any other alternative proofs we could have looked for, there will only be the answer to the overall goal is going to be no. Okay, whereas on the other hand, if we ask not of something that doesn't succeed, then we should get yes, we should get success, right? So let's see what happens if we ask not of member 5 in the list 2-1. So 5 isn't in the list, so therefore not of that should succeed. So how does that work? Okay, well, again, using the definition, we can expand this not predicate out to solve the thing inside the not, and then solve cut, and then fail. Otherwise, try just solving the trivial goal true. And again, using the definition of membership, we can go down the list and use the second rule to say, okay, 5 wasn't equal to 2, so but maybe it's in the list 1. And then we can say, well, 5 wasn't in the list, it wasn't equal to 1, but maybe it's in the empty list. And well, nothing's in the empty list, so that's going to fail, so we'll be stuck at this point. But now, since we never got to the cut, this alternative proof branch is still there, and we can backtrack all the way back up to here and solve this, and true always succeeds, so we're done. So we should get a yes out at the end. And in fact, I think if I just pull this up, you know, this shouldn't be surprising, hopefully, but and the other thing I should point out is that Prolog uses this somewhat more unreadable notation, backslash plus, for negation. Right, so this should fail, and that should succeed, and they do. Okay, so okay, let's see. Keep going. So right, so this is what I just said. Really, was that the official Prolog syntax for this negation goal that's built in is this backslash plus notation, which I think is supposed to sort of be reminiscent of the symbol for logical negation that you sometimes see in, for example, in the theory part of the course. But well, it doesn't really look that similar to me, but I think that's that's the motivation. So in addition, you can use this is basically a goal that you can use anywhere, you know, anywhere else that you can have a goal. So you can define predicates in terms of negation. For example, we can say Q of X holds if X is a person, and there's no, and it's not the case that teachers of XY succeed. So you can sort of read this as there's no Y such that teachers of XY succeeds. That is, X is not a teacher of any Y. But it's not always that the correspondence to logic isn't always quite as clean as for ordinary clauses. So let's see how that example plays out in on this data. Say we have two people and one of them teaches the other person. Let's say that we ask this Q of X predicate. So is X a person? Find X's that are people and such that there's no Y that X teaches. Okay, so if we expand out the definition of Q using this rule, then we just need to solve these two goals again. And now there are two choices, person A and person B. So now to solve the second part, we want to say, okay, solve the goal not teachers of A and Y. That is, try and solve teachers of A and Y, and then if that succeeds, fail, and otherwise succeed. So from now on, instead of breaking things down into cut and fail definition, I'm just going to kind of, when we enter a negation, I'm going to kind of draw a gray box around the part of the proof that draw a box around the part of the proof search tree where we're trying to search for the negated goal, because any bindings that we produce in searching for that goal are going to get discarded no matter what. So there's kind of a disconnection between the Y inside this gray box and the Y in the rest of the search tree. So in particular here, if we have, you know, we want to say, can we find a B? Can we find a Y such that A teaches Y? And for A, this fact here provides Y equals B, and so the teacher's goal succeeds. Okay. And so that happened inside the box. So we're going to, you know, when we find a solution here, we're going to basically forget what the solution was, and the overall result of the negation subgoal will be failure, okay? So this is just kind of a mnemonic notation for keeping track of where we've sort of, where we've, when we have a negated subgoal, we want to remember that that the bindings are gonna be forgotten. Okay, so since this failed, we're going to backtrack up to this point because there was another rule we could have used to solve the person subgoal. And we could have, in particular, we could have filled in B. And so we can say, so there's a typo there, that should be teaches B of Y there. So we can say, okay, let's try to solve not teaches of BY. And so to do that, we'll again introduce a box here and sort of remind ourselves that the Y inside the box is not the same as the Y outside the box, and see if we can find anything that unifies with teaches of B and Y prime. And there actually isn't anything, because this was the only thing we knew about the teaches predicate, and this is an A, not a B. So that inside the box will fail, okay, and we won't learn anything more about Y no matter what. But since this is inside a negation, the overall goal will succeed. So we'll find one solution where X is equal to B and we don't know anything about Y. In fact, Y wasn't mentioned in the original goal we wanted to solve, so that's fine. Okay? So the logical behavior that we've gotten here by having this this extra variable Y here is kind of like saying, let me write it on the board. We have, this is kind of like saying, sort of like saying there not exists Y such that teaches XY, that is, there's no person Y that's taught by X. But that's kind of an artifact of the fact that the Y wasn't mentioned as an argument of the predicate, so there was no way we could have specified Y in advance. Okay, but so it turns out that with other uses of negation, depending on which things are ground, you can get different behavior. So it isn't always the case that that there's a direct correspondence to logic for these kinds of goals. So the other thing I wanted to point out here is that with negation, the order in which we solve the goals can make a difference, which wasn't as much the case for the pure fragment of prologue. Before, it could affect termination, but not which answers you get. But in the presence of negation, the order in which we solve the subgoals can affect which answers you get as well. So specifically, if we try to solve the negated teaches goal first, then if we expand out Q of X to this definition, then we'll try to solve this negated goal, and that will go inside a box. And here again, this X and Y inside the box will not relate to the X and Y outside in this goal here. So we'll try to solve this teaches XY subgoal. And that matches this, obviously. So we can take X to be Y, A, and Y to be B. And so we'll succeed inside the negation. And then the overall negation proof search will fail. And that means that, well, we had to solve this subgoal, and we showed that there weren't any solutions at all, so we're just completely stuck, and there won't be any solutions to the whole thing. So in other words, having this teaches subgoal first forces us to gives us a logical interpretation of there not exists X and Y such that teaches of X and Y hold, rather than, because at this point, if we try to solve the goal Q of X, where X is a free variable, then we won't know enough about X in order to be able to find a concrete, to be able to find a situation where teaches of XY doesn't succeed because of the free variables. I'm maybe losing everybody, so let me know if that's really unclear and I should try to explain it again, because it's kind of twisty. Nope. Okay. Okay, so let's look at some more interesting applications of negation. So we've seen situations like in defining recursive predicates like ancestor and so on, where we're using recursion to, in some sense, to search a graph, for example, the family tree graph. But in particular, you can define a sort of generalized finding predicate by saying, okay, we can get from x to x in any graph, and we can get from x to z if there's an edge from x to y, and then we can get from y to z. So this sort of is fine logically, but if the graph has cycles in it, then it will almost immediately go off into infinite loops. So for example, if I just pull this up here, we have maybe a little graph with four edges and three of which form a cycle. If we just say find something like AD, then, well, in this case, it just runs out of memory immediately, but you can also get it to spend quite a lot of time without running out of memory. Essentially, here, there's no way to get from A to D because D isn't even mentioned as a possible node. What happens if we do find AC? So for find AC, we succeed. For find AA, we succeed. Yeah, so we are able to find things that are in the graph, but if there's a path that isn't in the graph, then we're going to get errors. So, and the reason is there's no way to, if you think about a classical graph search algorithm in which you might implement in Java or C or something like that, you would normally keep track of which nodes you've already visited so that you don't sort of keep visiting nodes that you've already visited over and over. So we haven't tried to do anything like that here, and basically that's why we encounter these out of memory issues. So one way we can deal with this is to say, let's, in addition to keeping track of the start and the end vertex of the path we're trying to find, we also keep track of the nodes that we've already visited, and if we are about to go someplace that we've already been, then we stop. Okay, we stop ourselves from repeatedly visiting the same node over and over. So one way to do that is to add a parameter to the find predicate that basically is a list that shows the path that you've followed so far. Okay, and whenever you are about to take a step whenever you're going to follow an edge, check to see that the endpoint of the edge isn't already mentioned in that list. And if it is, then stop, and if not, keep going. So we can do that by saying, okay, if we're about to go from X to Y, first check, this should probably be member YP, but first check that Y is, I guess it doesn't matter, that either X or Y is not something that we've already visited, and if so, then try to then keep searching, starting from Y and trying to get to Z, and add X to the list so that we don't try to visit X again. Now, this is a little bit backwards, but it's approximately doing the right thing. So if we do that, then we should get something reasonable, right? Right, so now we do actually get a concrete no answer when we ask, can we get from A to D, where D is something that we know we can't, shouldn't be able to get to. One thing I didn't check was, what happens if we ask, the original find predicate to just find all pairs of nodes that such that one is reachable from the other. And so the non-termination sort of comes through more clearly here, because I can sort of, there are going to be longer and longer and longer paths that go from between A, B, and C. And so we're never going to run out of possible solutions here. Whereas if we try this second find predicate, then hopefully, I need to give a list. Well, we can see what happens. Well, so we'll still always be able to get from X to Y if they're the same, and from A to B, A to C, A to A, and so on. So hopefully eventually we'll run out of possibilities, yeah. So that's good. Maybe we can do better if we don't, you know, because there's a certain amount of symmetry in the problem. But let me just check. I think the main thing I want to stress is that actually, I've said this before, but it bears repeating, that the order in which you solve the goals can make a big difference as to the actual meaning of the program. So in the presence of negation. So this is something that we saw in the first tutorial, but let me just repeat it again. For example, if you have a negated equality or unification goal, or where you start out by saying, see if we can unify x and y, where x and y at this point are free variables that don't have anything bound to them yet, and then solve x equals a and y equals b. Well, you know, this logically, if you think of this as, you know, can we find an x and a y such that x and y are different and x is a and y is b, well, this should succeed, right? Because, here we've actually given x and y and they are different. But when we try to solve not x equals y, where at this point, before x and y become bound, then that'll really work out to be solving does there exist x and y such that x equals y? And that's sort of, let me write that, because it's always tricky to. So this really would work out to not exist xy such that x is equal to y. And that's sort of the same in classical predicate logic terms as for all x and y, x is not equal to y. Okay, so logically this is not true in general. I mean, there are certainly taking x and y to be the same thing provides a counterexample to for all x, y, x not equal to y. So if you try to solve the not x equals y subgoal first, then you're really giving a different, the goal corresponds to a different thing in logic than if you solve it after the things have been bound. That is, if you solve it after x has been bound to a and y has been bound to b, then you're really solving not a equals b. And since both things are ground, that's really, you know, there are no free variables at when you encounter this goal at runtime, that's really the same as saying is a not equal to b, which is obviously true. So the most important sort of basic rule for keeping track of whether the logical interpretation of negation matches the sort of syntax of the program is that it's safe to use negation if the negated goal you're trying to solve inside the negation, if all the things that sort of in the program are variables are guaranteed to be ground by the time you try to start solving the goal, then it's guaranteed to coincide with logical negation without having to worry about these free variables. And if there are free variables, either, you know, variables in the program text that don't get instantiated, or maybe terms that have been bound to those variables that have other free variables in them, then those will sort of be treated implicitly as being existentially quantified at that point. And the reason this is, you know, so tricky to deal with is that you don't necessarily, unless you convince yourself that all the free variables will have been instantiated with ground things at runtime, you can't really tell which things might, you can't really figure out by looking at the program what the logical behavior will be. So the sort of general guideline or heuristic is to try to delay the negation until after the point where other goals have been solved or maybe arguments have been provided as part of the predicate T to ensure that the variables in the negated goal will be ground. So sort of try to put negation as far towards the end of the body of a rule as possible, while still, giving you reasonable behavior. Okay, so again, are there any questions about that before I move on? Because I'm going to change subjects pretty drastically now. Nope. Okay, so the second topic I wanted to cover today is called dynamic predicates, or the predicates called assert and retract, that also have side effects on the state of the system. So that in the sort of directly violating the declarative nature and the correspondence to logic. So far we've written programs by writing little text files that have rules in them and loading them in. So those are static predicates. Those are things that you're explicitly declaring to the system, and it knows they're there when before you try to solve a goal. There are also things called dynamic predicates that are clauses or facts that can be inserted or removed from the knowledge base from the prologue from prologue's collection of rules and clauses at runtime, even while you're solving other goals. So the first predicate that does this, that has a side effect on the state, is called assert. So let me just do some examples. So I can just pick a basic symbol P and assert it, okay. And then if I ask if P is true, then I get yes. If I ask some other thing that doesn't exist, then I get no, and I can maybe assert that too. Okay, but I can also assert rules like, that won't be much good, but I can assert that R holds if P and Q hold. I guess I maybe need more parentheses there. Yeah, I think, let me just try this. Yeah, okay. So the dot inside would have wouldn't be syntactic, because this thing inside here is really no, that's not display. The thing inside the two parentheses is really a term that has head symbol, colon dash, and arguments R and P and Q. I don't want to go too far down that particular rabbit hole, but the point is that the things inside the assert predicate are just ordinary syntactic things, which some of which happen to have interpretations as goals. So now if I ask if R holds, then I should get yes. In fact, I can also assert rules with free variables. Let's see if that works. No. I need more parentheses. Yeah, and then if I assert R of 1, well, now I don't know enough yet to be able to solve P, because S hasn't, because the predicate S hasn't been filled in yet. But I can also assert S of 2, and then I should be able to get a solution with X being 1 and Y being 2. Okay, so basically any ordinary kind of predicate that I could define through putting it in through a separate file, I can also insert into the dynamic state. So why would I want to do that? Okay, so that's a good question. And so one application is that we can use assert and retract instead of the negation approach to searching a graph. We can use assert, we don't need a retract yet, to keep track of where we've been already in the graph without using an explicit list and passing it around, but just sort of whenever we see something assert we've been here already and don't keep searching if you get here again. So here, for example, I've taken the find predicate and changed it so that instead of saying not member of X in P, I'm saying not visited X, where V is short for visited. So I'm saying if I haven't visited X yet, then okay, make a note that now we visited it and see if there's an edge between X and Y and then keep finding from Y. Okay?
What's the dynamic on the first
line? That's a good point. So I'll point this out again later, but basically this is a kind of a directive to the Prolog system that says in an external source file, you have to explicitly declare predicates that are going to be dynamic. I think that's so that you know the implementation can do more efficient things for predicates that are static, like you know avoid runtime dispatch. So, if you add dynamic, if you add predicates using assert and retract at the command line, you don't need to make this declaration. But if you put code into a separate file that uses assert and retract, then you do. I'll just actually show you the code here so you can see that this is here in the code that that I've defined corresponding to this find predicate on the slides. So this still has the right behavior if we ask, can we get from A to D? If we ask, can we get from A to, what X's can we get to A from? Well, we get A, and this probably has a bug somewhere. Sorry about that. I think this is probably a better way to do it. So the way I was doing the defining the find predicate before was a bit stupid, but this should be a little bit better. Okay, so this still has, still has a bug, but I'm not going to keep trying to debug it online here. But the point is, this is still doing essentially the same thing modulo being, you know, fundamentally wrong in some way by keeping track of where we've been before so that we don't go off into an infinite loop. Okay, so now we can add predicates. What if we want to remove predicates at runtime? Oh, sorry, let me just give another example of using assert. So another thing we can do that is hopefully a standard trick that you've seen before in other courses is memoization. So there's kind of a classical example of memoization where if, for example, you're calculating something recursive like the Fibonacci sequence, if you calculate it naively, then you might recalculate the same element of the sequence over and over and over. So for example, if you calculate Fibonacci of 100, then you might wind up calculating Fibonacci of 5 some huge exponential number of times. So here's a naive definition of the Fibonacci sequence in Prolog where, you know, we say, okay, the zeroth element is 0 and the first element is 1 and the nth element is k for some n bigger than or equal to 2. If we find the n minus 1th and the n minus 2th elements of the Fibonacci sequence and then add them together, okay? So this is saying, okay, m is n minus 1 and then p is m minus 1, where then p is going to be n minus 2. Okay, so I'm assuming you've seen the Fibonacci sequence before, and this is just the naive way of doing it in Prolog. So if we want to make this more efficient, one way to do it is to, whenever we have calculated some element of the Fibonacci sequence, we write it down somewhere, and then the next time we try to calculate that element, we look and see if we've already got it written down and reuse that instead of calculating from scratch. So that's called memoization. And so the way we adapt the program to do a memoized version of Fibonacci is to say, okay, we'll use a dynamic predicate called memofib, that'll just be a lookup table, okay? And so the first rule for the Fibonacci sequence will be look and see if we've already solved this element, found the solution for this element, and look it up. If we can solve the goal memofib n of k, then we already know that k is the nth Fibonacci sequence element, and so we'll just return that. And also, don't keep trying to, alternate solutions, because this is the one. Okay, so we can use the cut to commit to that answer. And then the first two rules are the same, and the final rule is going to be the same as before, only when we get to the end, now that we've calculated the Fibonacci sequence, we can just use assert to write down the answer that we've just calculated so that we can reuse it. Okay? So I think that should be in here somewhere too. Yes. And so if we calculate Fibonacci sequence of 100, it will probably take a while, or I guess it just won't let us do it. And let's see if we can do it using Fibonacci sequence with memoization. So basically, without memoization, we run out of, run out of space for remembering all the different parts of the proof search tree to search. And with memoization, it's just, more or less a linear thing. We just do a lot of addition and we're done. Okay? Right, so besides the basic assert predicate, so remember, the order in which clauses occur in the program matters. And so there are two variants of the assert predicates that let you say whether you want to add the new predicates that you're defining, the new clauses that, or facts that you're defining to the beginning or to the end of the database. That is, if you use assert A, then sort of alphabetical order A and Z, then A means putting things at the beginning so that they'll be the first things that are tried, and Z means putting things in at the end. Right, so now back to retract. So retract, basically does what you would expect. It looks for dynamic predicates that are in the data in the knowledge base and removes them. And the only thing I want to point out is that it can, it will try to remove one predicate at a time, the first match it finds. And if you ask it to keep finding solutions, then it will keep removing things. So let's say we have asserted P of 1, which I think was already asserted, maybe, and P of 2, and then let's say say retract P of X, okay? So I'll get one solution for X equals 1, and if I don't keep going, then if I ask what things are still true, then P of X will still be true for X equals 2, and then I can retract that as well by doing retract P of X again. And then once I've retracted that, there aren't any more matches for P of X in the database, so retract will stop. Okay. So this is answering the question you had before, but just it's on the slide so that for future reference. If you use assert or retract on a predicate that's not already defined in the program, in the interactive loop, then Sixtus at least will assume that you really meant to say dynamic before you did that, and it will infer that for you. But if you want to use assert and retract on predicates in programs loaded in from separate files, then you need to explicitly declare the predicates that you're using dynamically using this. And that's for your reference in case you want to do that, but the number of, you know, this is not the kind of thing that we would, you know, expect you to remember on an exam, for example. So assert and retract are, you know, themselves potentially things that could be used on the exam, but we would not not worry about this kind of sort of this kind of thing. But it's good to know about in case you want to write programs on your own that that use this. Okay, so I'm going to move on now and talk about ways to collect all the solutions to a given predicate. So, for example, we've talked about you know, finding, searching graphs and using defining ancestor and parent predicates. And so we might like to define a predicate that takes called ancestor list or a list that takes one argument being an atom that's the name of the person in the family tree graph, and another argument that should be bound to the list of thing the list of ancestors of the first argument. Right, so we and I'm not going to try to give a detailed proof of this, but you just sort of can't do this in the pure fragment of Prologue. It's not there's not a way to collect information from different branches of the search tree. So, even if you have something like cut or negationist failure built in, you can't quite do it. There is kind of an evil way to do it once you have assert and retract, and I'll just show it to you as an example of the kind of, you know, sort of low-level and hacky Prologue program that you shouldn't be writing, but because it's, you know, it at least does show that you can do it. So let's say we want to collect the ancestors of X into list L. One thing we can do is to say, okay, let's write down a list on in the knowledge base called, say, P, use a predicate to hold the list P, and then we'll run another predicate called collect, and you can think of collect as sort of saying, okay, keep trying to find things that match, that are ancestors of X. And whenever we find one, add it to the list and then fail so that we'll backtrack. Okay, so what this will do is keep trying to do something that will have a side effect on L, but will never actually succeed. Okay, so when it ultimately fails, this will backtrack and try the other half of this OR goal here, and then that will match. We'll solve the goal P of L, and that will find the list as it is now, having been updated by the collect predicate. And now, also, just to sort of clean up after ourselves, we can throw away P of L. So the way the collect predicate goes is it tries to find an ancestor of X, and if we find one, then we get rid of the old list that's in the knowledge base, and match, figure out what L is, what the last version of the list is, and then cons Y onto the beginning of the list and assert that. And once we've done that, we've had a side effect on the knowledge base, but we don't actually want to succeed. We want to keep going and find all the other solutions to ancestor. Okay, so if you understand this program, then you understand everything that we've done so far pretty well, but it's not really something you want to do every day or really ever. So there are other ways of doing essentially the same thing in a much more declarative and transparent way based on some built-in predicates that essentially do this but wrap up all the sort of ugly side effects inside the implementation and actually also give the implementation an opportunity to do things in a better way if it can detect what you're doing. So there are three built-in predicates that let you do roughly the same thing. And one of them is called find all. So find all is sort of the simplest one. So here's how we could write the ancestor list predicate using find all. So we take three arguments. The first one is variable, and it shouldn't be bound to something concrete when we call the predicate. And the second argument is a term which we can interpret as a goal. So it's in this case, and that normally we'll mention Y free, okay? So the idea is, and the third predicate is, can be anything, but normally will be a free variable that we want to be bound to a list once we've solved the predicate. So the idea is, you can think of this as saying, collect all solutions Y to this goal in list L. Okay, so for example, if we run this against the Simpsons ancestor database, then we get, okay, Homer and Marge are Bart's parents, and then these are his grandparents, and that's it. That's all we know in the in the database. Similarly, this well, so I lied a little bit when I said this has to be a variable. This term can actually also be something else, like a term that serves as a pattern with some variables in it. And so the way this will work is, if there are multiple variables here, then we'll try all find all solutions to this goal that in terms of these variables x and y, and for each possible binding to x and y, we'll build a list containing this term with x and y replaced with the appropriate solutions. So if we want to find all the pairs that are in the ancestor relation, we can do it this way. We can say, find all pairs x and y such that ancestor of x and y hold, and collect the solutions in list L. Okay? So there are, so I think I've said all of this. The main point I want to make here is that for find all, any free variables in the goal besides the ones in the first pattern argument are going to be treated as existentially quantified implicitly. So in other words, if we, I'll give examples of the difference in a slide or two. So now there's another predicate called, another two predicates called bag of and set of that have similar behavior but slightly different in a couple of subtle ways. So first of all, in simple cases, they generally behave quite similarly to find all. So the first difference is that, this is basically saying that using bag of, you can solve the ancestor list predicate just as well. But one difference is, if there are free variables in the bag of, in the goal of a bag of, then instead of getting one list with all of the possible solutions, you'll get multiple solutions with one binding for each, with bindings for the free variables of the goal that aren't mentioned in the pattern. Okay, so here we're saying, show me lists L and sort of implicitly also values X such that L is a list of ancestors of X. Whereas if we'd, in fact, let me show you the difference dynamically, because I didn't show it well in the slides. If I have YX. So here's the difference. If I do find all with the same goal, then I'll get one big list with all of the y's that are an ancestor of anybody. So this is saying, find all y such that there exists an x, such that y is an ancestor of x. Whereas if